Single cat.
Okay. All right. Good evening, everybody. It is Monday, September 19th, 2022. It's 8:27 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time. This is the Fakeologist Show. I do this show Sunday through Thursday between 8 and 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. Tonight we're a little slow off the hop because I actually had two guests lined up tonight, and the first guest didn't respond until the last minute, and then I had already booked another guest, and then I couldn't get a hold of that guest, so I was at 8 o'clock, I had no guests. So then I thought, oh, this is strange. Did my emails go through? What's the technical issue? Is there something going on here? And I did finally connect with one of the two. And either way, I would have made a show out of it. You know me. And that's what we're going to do tonight. So first it was no guest. Then it was one guest. Then it was two guests. Then it was no guest. And now we have one guest. So how's that for you? So we have a special guest tonight. We've been talking about communitarianism for a couple days now since I rediscovered it and got reinterested in it. That's just how my mind works as I search the internet looking for stuff to research and indulge myself. And I've spent many, many video hours watching and listening to Nikki Rapana, who wrote a book about communitarianism, and she started her joined the Anti-Communitarian League, and I got really interested in that. And then I thought, is there anyone else in the world talking about this? You know, as I always do, I figure I'm the only one looking into it, and maybe I only find one or two other researchers, and then I just start asking people to discuss it. And last night we talked to Rolt in Idaho, and he said, hey, have you heard of a guy named Lark in Texas? I said, nope. And he said, well, look him up. So we looked him up on last night's show. And then I fired off an email to a contact on one of his pages. And boom, he's on the other end of the line. So welcome to Lark in Texas. Hello.
Well, how do you do? How are y'all?
We are fantastic. You're talking to the Fakeologist in Toronto on Terrible Canada. I like to rename the province that I live in, as we are one of the more tyrannical regions in the world. So, and I think you are, your website says Richardson, Texas, I believe?
The website doesn't, but I am in Richardson, Texas, which is, of course, adjacent to Dallas.
Okay.
The home of Texas Instruments.
Right. And J.R. Ewing.
Yeah, indeed. I actually lived in Fort Worth a long time.
Okay.
And, of course, that's the home of the Southwestern Exposition and Fat Stock Show.
And what show?
Fat Stock Show.
Fat Stock Show.
That's right.
What is that?
It's basically a big rodeo.
Oh, okay.
And cattle auction, and it's quite the event in the Southwest in Texas. You know, Fort Worth is where the West begins, or at least the way they brand the city.
Right.
And there was quite the rivalry between Fort Worth and Dallas for many years, but
it looks Dallas like one megapolis on my map here. I'm just zooming out,
yeah.
And it looks like one big massive area here. What mega region are you going to be in America 2050? Do you know?
Well.
I guess Southwest or Southeast.
Essentially what we're talking about, and it's a term that emerged in the 70s. This is, of course, a metroplex.
Right.
And if you look at the population of this metroplex, we would probably rank somewhere around the fifth largest in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of what's called the Golden Triangle in Texas, which includes Houston. And, I don't know. It's been years since I looked at into this, but there's quite a history of this area down here. The word Texas itself comes from a Caddo Indian word, which means friendship or friend. And all the major cities were basically named after Freemasons. Austin, Houston.
You're right.
Even Dallas.
You're right. You're part of the Texas Triangle mega region. I'm looking at the map, if you can see your screen, of America 2050. And yeah, I'm pretty sure, I brought it up to you because I'm pretty sure you've seen or heard of this before. This is how America or North America is going to be re-divided up very soon.
Well, you know, regionalism is a hallmark of a socialist economic model.
Right.
And people have been talking about regionalism for many years. But, of course, communitarianism is a type of socialism. People will object because everybody has their own understanding of socialism. But it's really what the United Nations was always about. It was what the League of Nations was always about prior to that.
Right.
And yet the model that has emerged is actually a totalitarian model in this information age. And the one best word in the English language to describe it is communitarianism, because, of course, it's undergirded by what's known as communitarian law. And, of course, communitarian law in the French is acquis communautaire. Translated into English, communitarian law. It is the law of the European Union. And, of course, it was 70 years in the making. And, of course, since the creation of the United Nations, especially, they ratcheted up this idea of convergence theory, because that was really the plan, was to converge the cultural and the political and the economic systems of the East and the West. And, of course, that also would mean the the communist and or socialist nations with those of the West.
Right.
So that's what's happened. It's just been they basically adopted the Fabian model since its creation in 1884. And I remember Fabian socialist John Maynard Keynes in an address at Harvard University, at least according to a book written in 1960 by Zygmunt Dobbs, called Keynes at Harvard. Political deception as an economic credo, or words to that effect.
Okay.
But essentially what he said was that the Marxian socialists and the Fabian socialists were quite different paths. The Marxian socialists, of course, were trying to appeal to the laboring classes, people without property, and people who were essentially wage slaves. And, of course, those numbers are much greater than any other group, the so-called proletariat.
Right.
Well, the Fabian socialist reasoned, though, that they could gain more traction and get to where they wanted to be easier and faster if they appealed instead to the trust fund babies, the sons and daughters of the prominent and well-to-do, the people who were celebrities that were well-educated from the universities. And that's what they've done. And so this Fabian socialist model was characterized by gradualism or incrementalism. And so that's what we've seen happen. It's happened over the succeeding generations in America, just as it has in Canada.
Yeah. Well,
and
our crime sinister from the 60s, whose name was Pierre Elliott Trudeau, was mentored in the Fabian Socialist League, and he was on the far, he was in the far most far left party in Canada, and then he jumped into the middle party and basically did a coup d'etat of that party with help, of course. He wasn't alone, and he brought his Fabian Socialist credo into the middle of the political spectrum in Canada, and we haven't stopped going that way ever since. We've been stuck in there since the 60s. So,
well, even as unsophisticated as I was coming of age, I assumed we lived in a soft socialist country ourselves here in the States.
Yeah.
Although you have people on the right will say, oh, well, you know, Canada's just so socialist, you know, with their socialized medicine and.
Yeah, but you guys have socialized military where more than half your budget is paid for by taxes or stolen money and goes into the military, which, of course, is the police force of the world. So you guys get it all back through military spending and keep all the money in the country. But you go more corporate socialism, and that's sort of a thing that's never really discussed that I ever hear in the U.S.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the American people were fed a bill of goods vis-a-vis bad science, fake history, you name it. They essentially took over the public school system back in the 1830s and 1840s. And then John Dewey comes along at the beginning of the 20th century. And it's just gotten worse. Charles Merriam came along and advanced the cause. So the people in this country have been, frankly, brainwashed in the public school system. And then it extends into the university systems and then, of course, into the world of corporate America. It's really all flavors of socialism, and it's a cradle-to-grave system. But what I've been saying, you know, for years is that, well, you know, I hate to break it to y'all, but, you know, all this chicanery and all these things that we don't much like, it actually has a name. And for me, the light bulb moment was when I recognized its direct correlation to communitarian law, because, of course, it snuck in through these so-called free trade agreements. And, of course, through the healthcare system and the public school system and the university system, and it just expanded outward. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically we've been witness to, just like in Canada, frankly, the designs of people like Antonio Gramsci and Gene Sharp and Saul Alinsky and many characters. And you can't really distinguish between capitalist and communist anymore anyway. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't necessarily wear a label. You're not going to find people that are going to say, well, yeah, I'm a communitarian.
Yeah, if you did a survey, I barely can say the word. It's a real mouthful. And I guarantee, do you think even 1 in 100 people anywhere in the world know what a communitarian is? Or know what the concept is? Yeah.
Well, the reason is because they never say the word on your telly.
Right.
You're not going to read it in your local newspapers unless you read some review of some obscure book in the New York Times, for example. And so consequently, nobody has this word in their mind. They're not familiar with it. And you're right. It's a difficult to say, to pronounce word. It's got 8 syllables.
Oh,
and
really?
So why should anybody care about it? Because after all, nobody ever talks about it at the water cooler, at work, mm-hmm. At church, or even at your university. See, people today are compartmentalized. And the truth is that they don't recognize the fact there is such a thing as international law.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter where you live. People just don't want to look into it. They just want to ignore it because people are, by and large, rather parochial in their outlooks of the world.
Parochial means inward looking?
Indeed.
Right. Americans I always thought that Americans must have been the most parochial because they were told it's the greatest country in the world, so they never looked outward. So I thought the internet was good for America because then they could maybe start to see outside of their prison cell that was being built. And I always thought that America is the greatest was another psychological operation to keep Americans looking in and not even looking around the world to see what was happening. So I thought the internet kind of brought the rest of the world into America because just like other countries could use the internet to just look at other media? Because in Canada, we only get American media and we have our own, but for the most part, we all crave the American media. So we know exactly what's going on there. But of course, Americans, even on the borders, don't really know anything about what's going on in Canada because they don't get our media. So I said a lot.
No, I think you're right. I became acutely aware of this phenomenon really as a teenager and in my early 20s because, of course, my chosen career path was to be a culinarian. I wanted to be a chef.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to be a restaurateur and a caterer. And, of course, all my mentors were Europeans.
Right.
Or Asians. And so, you know, they let me know that, I mean, the French in particular, they regard Americans as really barbarians.
Right. They had another word for them, too. I can't remember what it was. I just heard that. Maybe it was on your podcast. I listened to a few of your podcasts with another person I never heard of today. And I listen to a lot of stuff, so I can't remember where I heard it. But Europeans refer to Americans as something really, it's a really ignorant term. But it's not barbarian, well, but it's just, yeah.
Well, see, my life experience was when I encountered people that were not Americans, mm-hmm. they were generally surprised that I could speak to issues related to their culture, their mm-hmm. cuisine. See, when you can talk about people's cuisine, you make instant friends wherever
right.
you go.
Everyone likes to eat.
And they like to talk about their food.
Yeah. Well, it's what we do a lot of. Outside of sleeping, what do? We eat a lot, lots. A lot of us eat too much.
Well, as a young idealist, I thought the only way we were going to save the world is that we were going to have to re-explore the values of localism. We're going to have to reconnect with people that produce and provide us our food. And because if you're not nourishing your body properly sharing in communion at the table with people who are properly sated and properly nourished, how could we cure anything about what's wrong in this world? If right. you've got sick people and everything about the design of society and cities really needs to be designed around the food system, in my
right.
view.
Yeah.
And it's not. And this is a problem.
Well, how did you, you trained to be a cook or a chef?
Yeah.
How did you get interested in communitarianism? Because it's a pretty strange topic to get into for anybody at any time. And I looked into it because some of the words today that you need to know, we hear many times now, regular people hear, is Agenda 21, Agenda 2030. These things have been, these terms have been thrown around quite a bit in the last couple of years as people try and figure out what the hell's going on, because it's not a virus and it's not this disease. It's something bigger, and the smart people are looking and hearing about these words. So when you hear Agenda 21, the next term is usually communitarianism at some point in time when you learn about what it's all about.
Well, I didn't get on the internet until 2004. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was a business person and yet was still somewhat out of the system. My business wasn't incorporated, for example. I kept at least a dozen people around to assist me in the business. I paid them in cash. And my bank account reflected the fact that I lost money every year in that business. So I didn't have a conventional type of business. I basically went against the advice of a lot of people mm-hmm. because I didn't really want to have a invisible third party named Uncle Sam as my partner, my overlord, telling me that I had to keep records and not be paid for such things. And I didn't think it was any of their business, my business.
Yeah. A lot of Americans think that.
Yeah. And so anyway, I kind of objected to that whole thing. And so anyway, everybody was saying that I was a Luddite and I was just so far behind the times. But what happened to me in 2004 is I was approached by a man that wanted to buy half my business. And I'm going, oh, hell, I'm going to have to tell him I don't really have a legitimate business. What I have is an inventory and what I have are sales. And if I don't make sales, I no longer have the means to be able to pay all the people that assist me in this business, you see. And I didn't have a digital calling card, didn't have a website. And of course, he was astounded that I could be doing as well as I was at the time. But the truth is I knew everybody in town. I knew people in five states. We had the largest inventory of new and used equipment under one roof in five states. And so I was constantly on the phone. And I remember finally giving in and deciding I had to have a pager. And I looked at those people that wore those pagers on their belts, and I thought, well, they just must be so important. It's so vital that people connect to them. And I'm thinking, yeah, I kind of like that look. You know, I want to be like that guy.
Yeah, I had a pager.
So then, of course, and I was always a late adapter to all this stuff. And, you know, then I got the flip phone.
Yeah.
I have the same phone number as when I got my first flip phone. And I had to give it up because they said I got a notice in the mail saying that they were no longer going to support the technology that I could trade it in and get a new phone. And so that's when I think I got my first smartphone.
Okay.
Which anyway wasn't a cool idea. But anyway, so the gentleman, he was an Iranian guy. And he didn't speak English well, but he had 2 degrees from Oxford in England. And he tells me, the guy worked for me off and on, just doing part-time work for, more than a year. And one day he said he wanted to have a conversation with me privately. And I brought him in to my business because with his training in electronics, he knew how to repair circuit boards. And to buy a new circuit board for a European piece of equipment or a lot of this high-end or high-tech assisted food processing equipment, these replacement parts were $600, $1,800. And here's a man that could go in there with a soldering iron, and he knew how to connect these things and make them work again. And I didn't know anybody else that could do that. So I paid this guy like $35 an hour, which for me was a lot of money to pay. I paid refrigeration techs $40 an hour. And if they're, and this is, of course, back in the day, this is before 2005 when I finally sold the business off. But anyway, he wanted to buy half the business. He explained to me that his father was a billionaire and that when the Ayatollah Khomeini came in and the Shah was forced to flee the country, his father was like his family was like the Bechtel Corporation of Iran. So major construction projects, and as I understand it. And so they had found favor with the Shah. And so when the Shah was ill with cancer, and then, of course, he was ousted. The Ayatollah Khomeini had been living on a commune in the south of France at that time. But anyway, he had siblings that were educated at places like the Sorbonne.
For the Ayatollah?
And I'm talking about the gentleman that wanted to buy half of my business.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Forgive me. I'm jumping all around. To make a long story short, so they wanted to bring me into the information age. So they understood the way I was, and they knew I was unsophisticated about the technology, but they themselves were sophisticated. He wound up marrying, arranged marriage to a woman in San Diego whose husband was a cardiac surgeon, and he passed. And so she had two small children, and then he had himself two small children. He came into the country because he married an American girl. And when they were divorced, he gained custody of the children. And so this family merged together. And so, like a lot of people that have means and that come in, that emigrate to this country, they want a business. And especially somebody like this gentleman who didn't have very good command of English. He was difficult to understand. he wanted to own something himself, because apparently he was having a hell of a time finding employment off and on. And, so that forced me to get online and get a website and hire all these techies. So I wound up blowing $180,000 over about 18 months to bring my business into the digital age. And when I saw what I was left with, I wasn't too happy about it. I mean, all my banking, everything related to the equipment was on the internet. There was a catalog now created. There was a file about every used piece of equipment, the work that had been performed on it, and everything else. And so the idea was that he would buy 49% of my company, and together we would form another company, which would be a service company. And this company, he would own 51%, and I would own 49%. And so that's how I got brought into this world of the internet. And okay. When I saw what was happening, I already knew about what Walmart had done to Main Street America. I could see that this idea of a bricks and mortars business was just not going to work in this new world. And so I sold all my assets off, and I haven't looked back since. And that was the end of 05. And, about that time, 04, when I first got online, I ran across this word, communitarian, online. And I said,
Why did you type that? How did you run into that? Because I've been on the internet a long time. How did you find the word communitarian? What were you looking for?
Well, I don't know. Whatever my interests are. You know, of course, I follow what foreign culinarians are doing, you know, because I always wanted to compete with the very best in the world when it came to my chosen occupation, my art. And I was a serious culinarian. I cared about the techniques, and you know, I wanted to be good, and I wanted my work to compare favorably with the best in the world. And that's how I was. And so in Europe, they were using that word more so than people in the States. Even in Asian countries, they were using that word more so than in the West, especially outside of Europe. Remember, they've been talking about this word. They've been using it in academia since the early 70s. And even the encyclopedia entries will tell you that it came in the aftermath of the publication of a book by John Rawls called A Theory of Justice.
John Rawls.
And I think he was, A Theory of Justice, 1971. And by that time, people like Amitai Etzioni had emigrated to the States since about 1958, where he was ensconced at UC Berkeley in California. He eventually made his way to, I think, Columbia and then the Ivy League. And I guess it was about 1990 or 91 that he founded the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University in D.C., Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
But along the way, there's been a lot of people talked about these matters. I was guest hosting a broadcast last night, and I made mention of an article that you can find on the internet. It's called Libertarianism as Communitarianism. And okay. That was from 1994. And another one from 1996 is by Fareed Zakaria, the CNN host, talk show host.
Yeah, my mother's in love with him. He's a commie, I think.
Well, that article was entitled from 96. It was called The ABCs of Communitarianism. You can still read it.
Wow.
People like Joan Vian was talking about this word in her books since about 1998. Another woman by the name of Jerry Lynn Ball, like Lucille Ball, Jerry Lynn Ball. The book, you know, she wrote 4 books or so, and she's talking about the word going back to 1997. And so even when I chanced upon the word in 04, I mean, we were already behind the eight ball 10, 20 years, you know, where we were not in the loop about these things, because most of these conversations occur in, you know, within academia, you know, in the think tanks and foreign and domestic policy circles. It's emerged really in all the occupations, fields of human endeavor, like psychology, for instance, or the amongst the behaviorists, and many different fields. But of course, the major media pathways have been you know, kind of merged with intelligence, like the CIA, for instance. It's true in Canada. It's true in Europe. It's true in Japan. All over the world, but they have to control the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Americans are just like Canadians. We're by and large dumbed down. We don't know anything about social contract theory. You know, the average American today can't tell you anything about liberalism,
mm-hmm.
for instance. And
well, they're just given Republican, Democrat. That's all they know.
Yeah, it's just really sad. And anyway, I've always wanted to have a kind of an intellectual life, you know, and the fact is I was in love with culinary art, and I didn't mind working 18, 20 hours a day because I was obviously a perfectionist. My reputation was always on the line. And so I cared about my work product, no matter if I was employed by somebody, if I was self-employed. It didn't matter. But anyway, that's the long and the short of it. I learned about something called Google Alerts because I was interested in something called copywriting at the time. And I thought, Well, maybe I can embrace this new technology. It looks like a lot of fun. Looks like you have the world as your oyster. And perhaps as a business person, I could do much better if I just use my brain. Instead of trying to be a bricks and mortars business and be all things to all people for my customers within 100 miles of me, for example. Now I could buy, sell, and trade with people around the world because now I have a digital calling card. So I started studying copywriting because I wanted to learn what the people on Madison Avenue knew, the people that were in the public relations field. And the like. And so that led me to understanding how people who are copywriters are some of the highest paid people in the world.
Hmm.
Because when you have that magic sales letter or that advertising campaign, a lot of times their compensation is tied to performance and to contracts. Because they're essentially working that gig economy too. So if your reputation is such that you have been able to do this for XYZ Corporation, and you did that for ABC Corporation, then you become demand because people don't really want to gamble more than they need to. They're looking for a proven winner. And so they're always looking for novelty. They're looking for a way to capture mind space. Mind space. And so that's what really mimetic warfare is all about. It's about real estate, and the real estate is, and the battle for the future is the real estate between our ears or mind space. But anyway, so I've been researching the topic of communitarianism really since that time. I got on, I signed up for this thing called Google Alerts.
I'm on that too.
And those years I was getting, 20, 30, 40 citations every day in my email inbox.
About communitarianism.
Oh, yeah. Or communitarian law.
Right. Okay.
And yet nobody was talking about it, at least that I knew. Nobody online. I looked at all these news aggregator sites like Rents and alternative talk radio and this and that. But the truth is you find evidence for this by following what they're doing in academia, because they are very proud of their conferences, their Zoom conferences, and they put them up on YouTube and BitChute and wherever else. One example is the Constitution in 2020 on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
How many people can you say actually watch that? Well, I'm one of these, kind of silly fellows that thought that was kind of worthwhile to listen to, because it involved the likes of Reva Siegel and Jack Balkin from Yale and people like Cass Sunstein. Cass Sunstein was, of course, married to Samantha Power, who was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And he was in the Obama administration. He co-wrote a book called Nudge.
Right, yeah.
Cass Sunstein.
Yeah.
And he talked about something that we know today as cognitive infiltration and the like. So naturally, I would want to know what these eggheads are thinking regarding the Constitution in 2020. Now, obviously, this wasn't something that was recorded and put up on YouTube just yesterday, but it's there.
Oh, it was just put up?
Oh, no, it's been there since, probably 2019 or 2020.
Oh, okay.
Constitution in 2020 on YouTube. And anyway, I was also curious. See, I've always focused on the law. And so I would go into the law reviews of these universities and started out with the mission statements. All of them were using words. All the universities, large and small, small college, major university systems, private universities, world-class universities, we're all using words like change agent and global citizen in their mission statements. And I'm going, wow, who's talking about this? Whatever do they mean? I remember my first taste of really getting into the minds of these people was the Brigham Young University Law Review. And those papers are generally written by doctoral candidates and the professors. And obviously the topic is law, all aspects of law. And they're quite proud of their publications that they share with anybody who wants to read them. And in the case of Brigham Young University, they go back to the 70s. So I remember entering into university in 72 myself, and I remember that I only stayed about 3 semesters. Before I finally decided that I didn't want to be brainwashed, and I left. And those years, I've told people that Students for a Democratic Society and every branch of the U.S. military was freely given access to every university campus in this country for recruiting purposes. And, of course, the Students for a Democratic Society was a front for Communist Party USA. The year I turned 16, 1970, was at the time of the largest street demonstrations in American history. And that was the inauguration of the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970. I remember that date because that's my mother's birthday. Obviously, 16 is a milestone for any young person. They are eligible to get a driver's license for the first time in the States. You're eligible to work, to legally work, although I had begun work before that, because you can get special permission. Of course, you get to work for less than a prevailing minimum wage, but nevertheless, I did. So, but that was also the year I was adopted formally, 1970,
wow.
by my stepfather. He married my mother in 1960.
Okay.
My senior year in high school, I got a job at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and it was called by then the Startlegram by the locals, because they were in a newspaper war with the Fort Worth Press, which I had previously worked for as a boy, selling these subscriptions door to door so I could win this trip to Disneyland. And of course, we're going to these small towns because they try to capture circulation as widely as they can, obviously. But anyway, Fort Worth Press went out of business. I got special permission from my parents. I answered an ad. They were looking for a so-called wire room attendant, and they were going to pay the astronomical sum of $1.75 an hour. The catch was you had to work the graveyard shift. So I had to get permission from my parents. Upon my interview, I was provisionally hired, but with her permission, I could start right away. So anyway, I thought that was quite romantic. You know, I'm going to be like Jimmy Olsen to his pal Clark Kent. Jimmy Olsen was the coffee boy or wire room attendant. And of course, Clark Kent in the Superman comic series was the star reporter for the Daily Planet. And that's when I learned about the Society of Newspaper Editors and Publishers. And that's, years later, I learned that Jim Mars, who was a crime beat reporter at the time, you know, he was involved in the JFK assassination, a lot of that research. He's written over 20 books. He passed away a few years ago. Anyway, he retired in this area. And one of my best friends in high school was the only son of the Fort Worth Police Department chief detective. Well, Jim Mars was delighted that I knew of this man, because that was his hero. This is the man that took him under his wing as a young man and showed him basically where all the bodies were buried. He knew all about the Blue Bloods in Dallas-Fort Worth, where they got their money, what were their vices. He knew about, for example, the Carousel Club in downtown Dallas and the Cellar Nightclub in downtown Fort Worth. And he knew about the gambling dens. And so that was quite exciting for him. This is a guy that was one of these no-nonsense tough guys that had no qualms about blowing you away if you crossed him. Fort Worth, of course, was the home of a man by the name of Cullen Davis, who was the wealthiest man ever tried for capital murder in American history. And, of course, he escaped judgment. He escaped punishment. People forget that people like Benny Binion of the Horseshoe Casino in Las Vegas got their start in gambling dens in Fort Worth, Texas. And I myself, years later, wound up working for Edward P. Bass, who his family owns about two-thirds of downtown Fort Worth. This is in the time of a man by the name of Charles Tandy, who founded Radio Shack.
Right.
He's also from Fort Worth. But yeah, I worked at a place called the Caravan of Dreams. And if you look that up in your encyclopedia, you're going to find there's a very interesting history one of the people that inspired it was a guy named John Allen, who goes by the name of Johnny Dolphin. And he was also the inspiration for what was called Biosphere 2 in Oracle, Arizona. But, you know, that kind of experiences gave me some insight into how people of different backgrounds and of different means thought, how they think. And, of course, as a caterer, a restaurateur, and a culinary artist, I generally found my best customers among the people that were willing to hire me, obviously. And most of those people were not so parochial. They were actually quite well-traveled. And they were a lot more sophisticated than your average person. And so, of course, you learn from these people. Not everybody gets to rub elbows with these kinds of people. People that are doctors and attorneys, and especially if you yourself are not a professional person, as I was not. But yeah, today the Google alerts for that word communitarian have pretty much dried up in the last 6 or 7 years. I only get them about once a week or every 2 weeks. And that's because the word has lost favor.
Right. What's it been replaced with? I really want to focus on... I appreciate hearing your background, but I really want to focus on the dangers of communitarianism and why we should be worried about it. And how are they ever going to get past? Because one of the things that I've been listening to Nikki Rapana, have you listened to Nikki Rapana's work on the subject?
Oh, yeah. I'm very familiar with her work. I may be one of the few people you'll ever meet that's probably read everything she's ever written that was at least published on the internet.
Okay, right. Yeah, she has a blog that I just found. There's two blogs. One is inactive and another one is actually there. So I have to review that one as well. But she really goes on about how without the Bill of Rights, which is at least 10 amendments to the Constitution, then America would be easy to flip over into a communitarian society. But right now, that's the huge stumbling block to get America into a form of communitarian law, which is necessary, I guess, to streamline America into the globalist society that they want to implement around the world.
Well, you know something? I was very, very happy to have discovered Nikki in 2004.
Right.
And the fact that she was writing about this, and this is in the years when you could download the first original copy of their book, which at the time was an ebook called The Anti-Communitarian Manifesto.
Yeah, it's still, I've got a copy of still, it.
Yeah, but that was revised in 2012.
Right.
And you want the 2012 revised edition.
Yeah, I think I have that.
So you probably do. And, anyway, so there was lots to write about for many years because, of course, with Google Alerts, it just arrives in your inbox, you know, and you pick a story and you blog about it and you write commentary. And, of course, like anybody that has stumbled on this word and focused on it for any length of time, they're going to be just like Nikki was and like I was and still remain astonished that no one seems to think this is worthy of discussion. And it absolutely is. So anyway, I wanted to help her and assist her research. And so I thought that I would help her in the ways that she admitted that she was not focused on. Early on, she was loath to go into the realm of religions and philosophy because that wasn't really her thing. You know, I thought she was so charming when she... I guess she studied journalism at UMass Amherst, but she didn't finish because she was just a typical young person. She found out she could make more money at the Playboy Club as a bunny.
She was a bunny? Wow, she was kind of cute.
Yeah, when she was younger, she was. But as we all realize, she supposedly passed away on the 15th of June this year.
I just heard about that about a couple days ago. Someone posted that link on one of the comments. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, she shared the same birthday as my younger brother, who was a year older than Nikki. Nikki was 2 years younger than me, and she was a year older than my younger sister.
Right. So I think she was 66 when she died this year. I think she's 66.
Well, she was 65, almost 66.
Oh, right.
Because her birthday was August 3rd.
Right.
And she passed away June 15th.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get her daughter on my show. I'm corresponding with her daughter, but apparently there was a big rainstorm in Anchorage today, so she couldn't get on. And they seem to
She's a remarkable young woman. She's got four children.
Yes, I've talked to her last year, so I wanted to get an update this year. She's very smart, and her mother brought her up while she was researching this material, so her daughter's well immersed in it.
Well, if you talk to her, Nikki's mostly been incommunicado with me over the years, and it's largely because, I mean, you know, life gets in the way, and she was the hands-on granny to those four boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are people that these are women with four young boys that if they didn't gather enough firewood, they could die.
I'll ask her daughter, but why would you choose to live such a rough life? Because it's definitely difficult to maintain your health under these conditions, to live an outdoor life. I know it.
Well,
what was the? Did she ever tell you what the reason was? Did you talk to her?
Well,
you said.
I can relate to her. Yeah, I've talked to her directly many times over the years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The truth is that she's an idealist, and I could relate because see, I was too. There are people that are idealistic, and it never leaves them. I mean, I'm one of these people that my first ambition in life was to be a poet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I was told, well, they don't make any money, and so you might as well give up on that. My mother said that, well, you need to learn how to type. Well, I like cursive writing, and I love calligraphy,
mm-hmm.
especially haiku poetry and Japanese calligraphy, because I lived in Japan as a boy. And I senior in high school, I decided to take typing. And then I got that job at the newspaper because my mother said, well, you know, you could be a journalist. And then you could write the great American novel and practice on your poetry along the way. But in the meantime, you could at least earn a living reporting on the news. So I don't know if you're familiar with what a wire room attendant does, or a copy boy. It's really a no-brainer job. You have these teletype machines in a glossed-in room, and they're running 24/7. And your job is to make sure that the paper doesn't land on the floor and cause the paper and the type to become soiled. And then you basically tear it off before it hits the floor, and you drape it across these wooden dowel rods outside the room so that it can be made available for the various newspaper columnists and the editors. And that was the only job. Because, again, this room had to be manned 24/7, day and night, because the teletype is running day and night. Well, of course, what you're getting is feeds from, like, the New York Times and Reuters and Associated Press, UPI, Knight Ritter, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Wall Street Journal, etc. And then I learned about this thing called the Society of Newspaper Editors and Publishers. And I realized that these people cannot report the news independently. They're constrained by contract because these are syndication services. And if you're a scriber to their service, and this is regarded as quite prestigious to belong to the Society of Newspaper Editors and Publishers, you have to be invited to join. And so you have to essentially follow the rules of the club. And the same with this subscription service. So I go home to my parents one day, and I said, you know, remember, I didn't get off until like 6 o'clock in the morning. I had to prepare for go to school. So at the family meal, I said, you know, I don't think I can. Before that, I told him I couldn't possibly be an attorney or a doctor because I didn't want to. I didn't want to be involved in organized crime. And of course, my mother wanted me to be an attorney or a writer. And my father, my stepfather, who owned a dental laboratory, wanted me to be a dentist or a doctor. And so one day I came home and I announced, well, you know, I can't possibly do something like that. That's not honorable work. These people are not independent reporters and publishers and writers. And so it's amazing to me that people chose that line of work, because I knew at 17 years old, it wasn't an honorable way to make a living. But again, that was me. And Nikki was the same way. She was an idealist.
Right to the end, huh? And it may have killed her, I guess, just being out in the open, living the rough life. Like you said, if she didn't get firewood, she would have froze to death.
Well, if you go on Facebook and you just scroll back to some of her posts, mm-hmm. you see this one post where she doesn't have her dentures in.
Oh, my.
And she looks like she's had a little sunburn. And remember, she was 65 years old. She wasn't a spring chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like she had to worry about the typical suburbanite that doesn't go to the gym and, you know, obesity and middle class spread and the like.
Right. I mean,
but anyway, yeah. So if you talk to Nord, you know, tell her, I think that it would be grand if one of these days before she passes herself or before her children passes, that they put up a monument to their mother.
Right. Yeah.
To her mother, because she did, I can't tell you all the years that when I had my coffee, turned on the computer, the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to see what Nikki wrote about that day. Or I wanted to see who made comment to one of her blog posts. I mean, I did this was a matter of course. Then I'd open up my email and see what Google alerts were there. So I was consumed by this subject since 04.
Right.
And I was like Nikki. Nikki assumed that, hey, when are the smart people going to get onto this? You know, when are the real writers going to get onto this? When are the people with means and status that have money to burn going to get onto this and realize this is a threat? You ask me why we should be concerned. Well, because what we're talking about is really two things. Is its threat. The first is depopulation, which is a euphemism for total war. And when we're talking about war, we're talking about the war against you and everybody you know and the people you care about most in this world, in this life. It is psychological, asymmetric, nonlinear, chemical. It is economic. It's cultural. It's spiritual. It's lawfare. Every kind of warfare that you can imagine, which is in fact total warfare, unrestricted warfare, just short of cannons bursting in the air, bombs bursting in midair, and or on the streets, and bullets flying. This is what it is. This is what depopulation is all about. It's total war.
Right.
And the other thing we need to be concerned about is, frankly, techno-slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And we can just as easily call it technological slavery or slavery. A lot of people don't know that slavery never went away anymore, that piracy never went away.
Mm-hmm.
We were told it did. You know, oh, modern people, they just don't, they're not going to fall for that. They're not going to believe that, and it doesn't happen in the real world. Well, it actually does. Technology, first of all, is a tool. And we have to recognize that's all the technology is. most of the time, it's a contrivance of man. And so it's a lot more than just a spear, an axe, an anvil, a fulcrum, or a lever, an automobile, a train, a computer. It's also language. Language itself, being a contrivance of man, is probably man's oldest technology. And don't forget, before we had an oral and a written language, there was such a thing as kinesics. You know, there was body language. So language is a big field of study. Roughly speaking, when we talk about language, we're talking about the study of signs and the study of symbols. So that would be semiotics and symbology. So not only is language a technology or a tool, but so is money itself. And so what's happening today is we're being enslaved by our own technology. We are amusing ourselves to death, borrowing from the parlance of the late Neil Postman, title of a book, Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Right, I've heard that.
So the truth is the American people, just like the Canadian people, have been weaponized against each other. In these large organizations, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. In America, for instance, I suggest that we have been under martial rule, law of necessity, under international law, since 1863. Others will say it's from 1860 on, because, of course, the GOP was founded as a Marxist institution, a party, and the first American Marxist president under the Grand Old Party was Abraham Lincoln. A lot of people just don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
His name wasn't Lincoln. His real name was Springsteen. His mother was Hanks, like Tom Hanks.
Oh, really?
The actor. Yep. He's a Shabbat Lubavitch gentleman, and he is a direct descendant of Abraham Springsteen's.
Ooh, he just dropped off. I was wondering why it got really quiet there. Oh, here you go. Oh, you're back. You dropped off for a second there.
Oh, my goodness.
But
is
you're back.
Now?
Yeah, you only dropped off for 5 seconds. All of a sudden, you were gone. Abraham Springsteen, why did he rename himself Lincoln? Was it after Lincoln, Nebraska? Or?
I think it's just common with these people. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, Lincoln goes back to the mother country, you know, the Lincoln Inn. You know, he was a railroad lawyer.
Okay.
So he represented the people who wanted to build track. And, you know, these were wealthy people in his day.
Right.
Railroad barons.
Right. So it was elite money. It's always the elites that end up ascending to the throne.
Anyway, during the war between the states, there was a conscript that became a major. He was had been a professor at Harvard College by the name of Franz Lieber. And he anglicized his name to Francis Lieber. And he was tasked by the Lincoln administration to draft what became known as General Orders No. 100. And this is known today as the Lieber Code. And what it did is it placed all Americans, north and south, everyone that could be called an American at that time, under international law, rule of law of necessity during a time of war. And this became known as the Lieber Code. And well, it's never been rescinded. There's no evidence that it was ever rescinded. So the question is beggared. Are we still under the law of necessity today? Are we under martial rule? There's only two rules. Number one, anything is permitted which will continue the free flow of commerce. And secondly, everything is permitted that will keep the peace. Those are the only two rules. So anything that will impede the free flow of commerce is permitted to be able to apply force. And the same with anybody that wants to keep the peace.
Mm-hmm.
Communitarian law is important for this reason too. What we stand to lose is really just one word, and the word is property. Now, don't forget, in 1841, the year that this word communitarianism was coined into English by John Wayne Goodwin Barmby, was a man by the name of Pierre Joseph Proudhon, who published a pamphlet in which he begged the question, what is property? And in it, he suggested that ownership of property was tantamount to theft. Mm-hmm. That was the same year that Clinton Roosevelt wrote something called The Science of Government, founded on natural law. It was the same year that Charles Mackey wrote Extraordinary Popular Delusions in the Madness of Crowds, mm-hmm. 1841. And so we have to understand the forces that were the thinking of the times. Prior to the publication of the Communist Manifesto in 1848, upon its publication, there was what was known in history as the revolutions of 1848 that broke out all over Europe in the major capitals. Well, the aristocrats put these things down eventually, and order was restored. Meanwhile, a lot of people that were leaders or participants in these so-called revolutions of 1848 fled to America to escape the long arm of the law. And these people became known as the 48ers. And so when you look at the history of these people called the 48ers, a lot of these people made up the ranks of the Union Army. And the truth of the matter is when you look at the leadership of the North and the South during that conflict, and remember, that was the greatest loss of life in conflict in American history. Estimates of 700,000 to 1 million Americans died in that conflict. And it wasn't so long ago. Many people have long memories of family members, and grandparents, great-grandparents, family Bibles, diaries, etc. And anyway, I'm not so much a historian, but you cannot help but look at true history to realize how it is that the greatest lie of them all is the lie of omission.
Right. Yeah, I heard you say that.
So that is just so true. And anyway, when we talk about property, what we're talking about is, I mean, when you think about it, if you can claim to own anything in this life, surely you can claim your own mind and your own body.
Right.
If you own nothing else, I mean, I'm thinking, well, why would anybody want to own my mind and my body, you know, when they've got their own, you know? But as it turns out, that's not how the communitarians see it. So if you do no longer have property rights, you cannot have privacy, and you cannot lay claim to ownership of even your own mind and your own body, then how is it that you're going to own the fruits of your labor or the place where you hang your hat up at night? So if you want to go back to my website and you want to look at the very top entry.
Okay. Are we talking about the blog?
That's what I discussed last night. Yeah. The title of the very first entry, if you go to the homepage, is 3 C's and a few words more.
Right.
And the one that I had written prior to that was called Trust Your Gut. which is immediately below it.
Or nine words. I put that on one of my blog. I reblogged that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the nine words is, you know, something I talked about last night. But see, there's never enough time for people if they don't want to read. Because the truth is that when we look at words, we're hearing them and we're reading them. Well, it's a good idea to be able to hear them and see them at the same time. If you're talking about things like communitarianism and the law and the like. Now, I don't think any of these things are complicated, but then I'm 68 years old. I don't know how somebody that is a careerist in the middle of their career with teenagers and they're running every day and they think they're well informed because they watch 30 minutes of the news at night. I don't know how they're going to relate to what someone like me is trying to spell out for them unless they can see it with their own eyes and hear it with their own ears. But that's just me. Yeah, and I'm not a techie. I just know that the public square today is the internet. And whether I like it or not, that's just the fact of life. And, you're just never going to gather any kind of an audience to a message. You know, you could be running through the streets and shout the British are coming and British are coming and no one will hear you in the realm of the internet, unless you kind of know what you're doing. And I don't.
But the whole,
so if you don't have privacy and the right under the law to own property, then by definition, you're a slave.
Yeah, that's right. And that's really what I was wanted to get you on about and talk about it, because the whole law that we have now is based, and Nikki made this quite clear in some of her audios that I put on fakotube.com. The whole law is based on property rights, and 9/10 of the law is about possession. So the communitarians, if they don't believe in private property and privacy, then the whole law is going to be thrown upside down and they're going to have to redo it all.
What they're going to tell you is that, well, you know, we are the wise ones. We are, we're better informed than you, about such things. You shouldn't worry your pretty little head about such things, but we are the caretakers. We represent the community, and the community and their rights supersede yours. Mm-hmm. The problem is a community can never really be identified. It's a nebulous concept. I mean, it's just like Uncle Sam. I don't know anybody named Uncle Sam. And I don't know anybody named community.
And this whole COVID scam is really based on communitarianism. All these ideas and concepts where we're not doing it for our own health, we're doing it for others. Those ideas that were pushed for a couple of years, complete communitarian communist type language that we're just not familiar with.
It's distinctly communitarian. It was put forward through public health law, so called,
right?
Which is really just policy.
That's okay? Right.
And it was born from the minds of epidemiologists and fake scientists and eugenicists.
Yeah.
And mass murderers and psychopaths and what's known as bioethicists, because, you know, they're smarter than you and me. They, you know, they're PhDs and they know better than you.
Yeah, but you're being sarcastic now for our Chinese audience. So yeah,
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I get the sarcasm, but not everyone understands it. No, they put their pseudoscience on top of everyone and they built this whole infrastructure over top of different countries called public health. And in Canada, I don't know, they did it differently in the United States, but in Canada, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, they created these agencies called Public Health Canada, and where I live, in the province I live, I think it's called Public Health Ontario. And these are just charities that they set up that the main funder is the government. But to me, and this is why I want to talk about communitarianism, it's a communitarian type structure where it's outside the government, but they get the government to pay for it, and they use all the words in their business name to make it seem like they're the government, to fool people, but really it has nothing to do with the government other than the government is funding it. And other nefarious NGOs like the Bill and Melinda Depopulation NGO, they're funding it as well and running it. And
well, let me see if I can rephrase rephrase. Yeah, I hear you. But let me see if I can rephrase that just a little bit.
Okay.
From my perspective. Of course, in a communitarian system, you have a mandatory partnership between the public, private, and the social sectors.
Mm-hmm.
The private sector is considered the world of, corporations and business, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And the public sector is regarded as the so-called government, the state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the social sector is really what's thought of as the public schools, the universities, and the churches.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a mandatory partnership. And so all these people have to be brought into the crime
mm-hmm.
syndicate. Okay. They all have to be made members.
Right.
Because see, this is a system of gangsterism, which is organized crime made legal. It's a system of child sex, drug, organ, and human trafficking
mm-hmm.
made legal. The law itself is making slavery illegal. And this is what communitarian law is all about. And that's why it is dangerous. And so when we talk about these charities, so-called, we're talking about NGOs or non-governmental organizations in Europe. We call them quangos or quasi-autonomous non-governmental organizations. And then you have this phenomenon that you just described as well that could be variously an NGO or a PPP or a 3P, which is a public-private partnership.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. What is the fuel? What is the energy that drives all of this? What is the motivation? What's the incentive? It's fake money.
Mm-hmm.
And all these governments are bankrupted. The governments themselves, which are themselves corporate entities,
right? Yeah.
They're bankrupted to their creditors,
right?
You know,
and if they weren't before, they sure are now. After the last 2 years of just tripling and quadrupling the debts, the overall debt is just—it's impossible to pay. And I guess that's the day of reckoning is any day now. Whatever day they're going to pull the plug on this whole fiat currency charade. Some people are saying it's going to be on the 24th of this month, which sort of lines up with the Shemitah. I keep hearing that from some people.
Oh, you're talking about this month? Rosh Hashanah?
Yeah. Somebody said September 24th, but others are saying that the guy in Germany who said that date was just, he was misspoken. He was just getting mixed up in his head. But yeah, there's a lot of people that think this...
Well, 24 is the eve of Rosh Hashanah. It begins Sunday the 25th.
Okay.
And it ends on Tuesday.
Well, they said something about the Shemitah, which is, I can't remember what that means, but many things.
What accompanies that message is that a lot of these economic downturns, these disasters that have occurred over time have occurred around Jewish high holiday. Like Purim and Rosh Hashanah. So, I don't know. I know that at the end of the day, contract law never goes away. But the fact of the matter is if you can't own property, if you can't own your little hovel hole, your little cabin beside the stream, you know, and gaze across a meadow, and that cow, that horse, those chickens are not yours, and your space can be violated at any time. And in fact, you're being surveilled 24/7 and your health is being harmed. What incentive do you have?
Not much. And the fact that they can just enter your body with poison, otherwise you're shunned from society, is the most egregious violation. And I guess that's part of communitarianism too. Where they can just
these people are, these people like this, was it Yuval Noah Harari?
Oh, yeah. He's a real wicked.
What a piece of work. I mean,
he's a wicked
guy. Honestly, thinks that.
A wicked.
And of course, I fear he's right.
Well, these aren't his ideas. He's just elocuting them. He's just saying what they believe, and he's perhaps going to help implement all this transhumanism nonsense.
Well, I don't know. Do you have a Facebook page yourself, or do you ever go over there?
I go on Facebook. Yes, I have a group called Unknown Causes, which I was just playing around with Facebook. I usually don't like to give any energy to their platforms because they can delete you on a whim. So I have my own platforms. I have my own video platform called FakoTube, as you've seen, and Fakeologist.com. That's my blog I've had running for a long time. And most of the stuff I just echo into their social media spheres. That way, if they delete my account, it's not a problem because I have all these posts on my own site. And I own my own data, but I'm only on Facebook just so I can click links that other people send me that I might want to look at. And
I only signed up for an account about 2009 mm-hmm. because Nikki announced at her blog that she was going to go over there.
Right. Well,
and so I wanted to support her, you know,
which is, that's where the people are, mostly women. Mostly women are there, and that's where they hang out. They think that's the internet. So that's where they are, which is too bad because it's a big trap, of course, as we know.
Well, I'm going to tell you this. There's a few people I follow on Facebook because mm-hmm. I've gotten addicted to it again these last few months.
Uh-oh.
And I try not to post too much in there because I've always felt creepy even having an account.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've always felt creepy even being online.
Right.
But that's just me. I follow a couple of women, and one is named Julianne Romanello from mm-hmm. Tulsa, Oklahoma. And another one is named Cindy Niles from, I think, Sydney, Australia. Not Sydney, Victoria,
okay.
Near Melbourne, Australia.
Her name is Sydney Niles.
Cindy Niles, N-I-L-E-S. She's got two pages and same name. There's the blue dress Cindy on the swing, and then there's the red T-shirt Cindy in front mm-hmm. of the body of water. And that the second one is the one that's, I think, usually more current. But see, these
So she's the one with okay. I see her now. She's with the pink outfit.
She's wearing a T-shirt, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's another one where she's on a swing with the blue dress. That's another one of her pages.
Oh, okay.
But see, these people, if they face all kinds of censorship and shadow banning and this and that with Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So they devise different tactics to make sure that they can still connect with their readers. And, you know, people form real friendships, you know. On these platforms, I suppose, even if they are, you know, living around on another part in another part of the planet. But I think it's wonderful because these women are very bright.
And yeah. Why is it always women? Seems like mostly women that are exposing this agenda.
Well, the men are out there slaying dragons, right?
Okay.
Julianne has four children. But, you know, she's a former political science and philosophy professor. And so she's a teacher. And Cindy used to teach English in Greece because she's of Greek extraction heritage, although she was pretty much raised in Australia. And so she has she knows a lot about the things that have happened in Europe over, you know, the last 25 years, that a lot of people from America, for instance, or Canada may not have the same perspective. And, you know, Julianne is living in really just what we used to think of as just an all-American city, you know. But if you read their post mm-hmm. and just kind of keep up with them, These people are, these two women and a lot of their associates, people that have followed them for years, I suppose, around them, are doing brilliant work. And I feel, you know, heartened by these people because, especially with Cindy and Julianne, they have a facility with the English language.
What's Julianne's last name? Sorry.
Romanello.
Okay. So she is also, okay, buzzwords translator and scrappy moms against singularity. Okay.
Yeah.
So they're into, they understand communitarianism too?
They do. They're coming on to it. They're, you know, just in the last couple of years, but you know, see, they're already very bright. And so they've picked up on it very quickly. And I think before Nikki passed away, I think she was just thrilled that there was, you know, a few dozen people there on Facebook that had followed her work for a number of years. And, you know, within the last couple of years, for me, people like, and there's others, you know, Tashi Sitford and Colette Strong. And I mean, there's a number of people whose name, I mean, I may never meet these people, but I'm just delighted that they picked up on this word and recognized its import. Because it needed to happen 20 years ago, you see, but it didn't. It's
well,
you know,
people
so
need,
I'm always looking for wherever I can find attraction.
Yeah, people need to be forced into figuring this out. They need to be. And this is what this has done. So before
I myself, I'm not gonna rest until 10 million people are talking about this on the same day.
Mm-hmm. Were you on The Missing Link, I think I heard you say? This is another talk show?
I was, yeah.
What day was that? He does a lot of shows, it looks like.
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I can look it up for you. And
do you post any of your... So you're... Where do you put most of your stuff? On Facebook or on your own site?
You know, I'm not really that much into advertising myself so much.
Yeah.
You know, because really it's not about me, you know.
Yeah, but if you want people to hear...
You know.
Yeah, but if you want people to hear your work, it'd be good to...
I'm excited whenever I can actually have an intelligent conversation with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I jokingly like to say that I keep looking for signs of intelligent life.
Right. Well, you found it here on this site. We got lots of it here where we are on the Fakeologist broadcast. We started off looking into just media fakery and 9/11 and hoaxes and all the things around us. And then, of course, this 3/11/2020 came upon us and didn't take any time for us to figure it out because people like Alan Watt have been talking about this for 20 years. Just this vaccine could be the way they bring in this totalitarian communitarian regime.
You know, I was asked to be a radio host mm-hmm. in 2011 by the owner of the network. It was out of Round Rock near Austin, Texas.
Right.
Public broadcasting.
Right. Okay.
And for the 2 years prior, I discovered that you could call into internet talk radio shows as mm-hmm. a caller.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't necessarily screen your call, and you could actually
talk. Yeah.
And I thought that was the most wonderful thing, you know. And so I felt like I had a responsibility if I was going to, you know, impose myself on people that I had to bring something valuable to the table. And so I made it my mission that I never would call. And I would call some of these radio shows two and three times or these networks two or three times a day. And I did this for a couple of years. So I tried to make my presence felt, but I never called without mentioning the C word once. And no matter what they were talking about, I could bring it in an intelligent manner into the mix of the conversation. And of course, what I was trying to do was force the host and the guests to adapt it and bring it into their consideration for topics that they were discussing. Because it literally impacts upon every single aspect of our life. It affects every occupation and every field of human endeavor. Now, that's a pretty grand statement to make, but I think I can prove that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so communitarianism is the one word that exists in the English language that anybody in this world that speaks English at all should be familiar with, but clearly they're not. And the evidence is that nobody's talking about it. It's probably the most important word that people need to get hip to and know of its import right now. But the evidence is they don't. Why? Mm-hmm. Because they never utter the word.
So who else do you recommend that people look at? So Nikki Rapana, for sure. Look at her old stuff. And I've got most of it on FACO too. Some of my favorite stuff.
Well, you can look at the work of Berit Joss from Crossroad Ministries in Norway.
Mm-hmm. Where is he found?
She is Norwegian, but her husband's an American expat.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a Christian ministry over there. They're older people now, but do a search.
How do you spell that? What is it, B?
Crossroad.to.
Okay.
Singular Crossroad.
Okay.
.to. Thomas Oscar.
Okay.
But you can do a search. The title of this piece, just to get you started, or your listeners, Cry, Our Beloved America.
Okay.
Sliding Down the Communitarian Slope. Cry, Our Beloved America.
Okay.
Sliding down the Communitarian Slope. This is from, like, I think 2010 or 11, somewhere in there. There's also something called the Communitarian Trap. You can search. That's a Christian woman on the East Coast of America.
Oh,
her website used to be called Fanatic for Jesus, hyphenated.
A lot of religious people study this.
But that's true.
Okay, sorry, what's that one? I'm going to type that one in next.
The Communitarian Trap. .blogspot.com.
Oh, okay. In fact,
the Communitarian Trap.
Okay. I'm putting all these in my show notes, by the way.
Pardon me?
I'm putting all of these in my show notes. So this will be note number 8.
Yeah.
That's number 8. I've got 8 show notes for tonight, including 2 of your links. Okay, so this is an older one. Yeah, I think I was looking at this today. What else do you recommend?
Remember, I told you about the article that's at Foundation for Economic Education. That's FEE.org. Do a search from 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Libertarianism as Communitarianism.
Oh, okay,
That's the title. Just search the title. And I have a link I can provide you.
I use the search. Presearch.org. Presearch.org. Do not use Google.
And, I'm an idiot when it comes to the internet.
No, you're not. You can figure it out. Presearch.org is fantastic. I found that article. I'll put that in. That's show note number 9. We've got lots of research to do.
How about the ABCs of communitarianism? The ABCs of communitarianism.
I'm getting good at typing that now. The ABCs of communitarianism. Okay, Slate Magazine.
There we go. 1996.
Boy, that's old.
Yeah, and by the way, Nikki's oldest published piece that I'm aware of on the internet is simply called Understanding the Third Way. Understanding the Third Way. And that was written mere weeks before 9/11.
Okay. Understanding the Third Way. You think the Third Reich in Germany was based on this idea of the Third Way?
Well, it was a socialist society.
Was it communitarian?
It is, in my view.
Yeah.
I don't think they were communitarian. Remember, the word didn't really enter into the parlance, at least in the English world, English-speaking world, until the early 70s. It was brought back into favor because originally it was a word that was bandied about in the 1840s, obviously. When you look at the etymology, and the gentleman who introduced it to the Brits, to Engels and Marx, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found the article. Yeah, I found it. I linked to it. It's citizenreviewonline.org, so we got that.
There you go. And then here's another one. Let's see. How about our common community? Mm-hmm. UK column. Our common community.
Okay.
Okay. And by the way, newswithviews.com is a website that's been around. Newswithviews.com. There's an article archive. The way to get to it quickly is just do a search. Communitarianism, a three-level con job is one title, I think.
Okay. I see that.
And
Rentz put that.
So
on.
Yeah, those are really punchy, easy. Yeah, Rentz has got an archive, but News with Views too. Okay, is another place. Newswithviews.com.
Okay.
And the reason these are useful for people new to the topic is you can read every one of these in 3 minutes or less.
Well, this is a Nikki Rapana article. Okay.
Yeah. So see on the side where you can go to other articles written by the same author?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, that's a very good resource.
Okay. Gotcha.
And, of course, most of my writing about communitarianism has really just been with email exchanges over the years. But the old website called Just an American, LarkinTexas.blogspot.com, those entries, by and large, going back to the original entry, because I titled each of these entries.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was called Diogenes, because I happen to like Diogenes of Sinope, one of my favorite philosophers, because he was from the school of the Cynics, which grew away from the Stoic tradition. The Stoic tradition sprung from the school of the Cynics, I should say. But be that as it may, those were the show notes that I published in advance of my radio shows so that my listeners didn't have to be burdened with taking notes while they were trying to figure out what the hell I was talking about.
Got it.
It gave them something to look at while they were listening to my horrible voice.
Okay. Where's your so you have a radio show that you usually fill in on?
No, not anymore. Not anymore. I am interested in collaborating with some people to do a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could be a good advisor to any such party that wanted to do something like that. But it needs to be done right. It needs to be thought right, thought through correctly. And the truth is it needs to have some kind of a marketing campaign attached to it to have any effect. And it doesn't have to be made a product that's for sale. And it doesn't have to cost really a lot of money. Really, it's just about some investment of time of people that care. And I just don't have the ability to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of knowledge about the subject. And by the way, on my new website, tinyurl.com/LarkinTexas,
okay.
you can read every word on that website in under an hour.
Do I already have that site on my screen right now, or is that another one? So is that this?
No,
is
it's the same. It's the same website because I just say I use the tiny URL because when I'm speaking, it's easier to hear. If I was to call out the letters,
on the actual
website, because see that's one of those free publishing platforms. That company Wix is in Israel, by the way.
Oh, great.
And I don't like to pay money. I just really want the stuff made available to people. However, you know, I'm not trying to sell anything. So,
mm-hmm. I gotcha. Well, I always self-host and I have to pay for that. So I occasionally ask for people if they want to support independent media, then they can make a donation. And on my site, they just go to fakeologist.com/donate. And we take money any which way you can think of, including crypto. Epic Cash, Monero, Bitcoin, credit cards, whatever you want to donate. Wrap your few dollars in tinfoil and mail it to the P.O. box at the bottom here. It's all possible. I really think people should support independent media, people that put the effort in. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it. You just pay what you think it's worth. It's worth a dollar, a coffee, which is probably about $10 today. Tomorrow it's going to be 20. Then wrap it up and make a donation. So that's how I keep going. That's what inspires me.
I'm not averse to making money. You know, when Nikki and her daughter discovered communitarianism, it was in the Roosevelt neighborhood near the University of Washington in about 1999, I think.
Yes, I've heard the story. It's
and
crazy.
I used to live in that same neighborhood in the 80s.
Wow.
And so I was no stranger to that neighborhood. You know, I was an 80s kind of a guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 68 now. So, I mean, I was still how long ago was that? 20-something years ago?
In the 80s?
40 years ago.
Yeah, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I was quite the hipster in those years, living in Seattle.
Right.
And there's a lot that I can, you know. So anyway, about that same time back in Texas, you know, I'm a businessman. And I remember that I was dealing with the Economic Development Department, City of Dallas, that was a partner in the Dallas Farmers Market Improvement District, which is at the edge of downtown Dallas. And I had a proposal put forward. It was owned by Belgian bondholders at the time. It was a $7.8 million proposal. So, I mean, I was a business person when she was discovering communitarianism. She was living in a rental facility. I think you've read the story, probably. But
She's told her story a couple times, yeah. It was interesting.
It's a fascinating story. And so, but see, I could relate so well to her because there's so many, we just had so many similar life experiences. As I indicated, my younger brother and her shared the same birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And I lost my younger brother in 2011. Mm-hmm. And
what happened to him?
All my nuclear family was murdered by the White Coats. My mother in 96.
Oh, the White Coats, right. Wow.
My stepfather in 2003. And then my little sister 4 months later. And then my brother, the one in the middle, in 2011. Within a 2 or 3 month period of after that, I was invited to be a radio host. And I remember I felt utterly alone in the world.
Jeez.
Utterly.
I'll just ask, what's your take on the whole COVID hoax and the vaccine? And what's your take on that quickly? Because we have to wrap up. We've been going almost 2 hours, which is great. But what's your take on, would you ever take a vaccine?
I haven't trusted the science and the peer review process of the allopathic medical model since the 60s.
Wow.
Okay. And so to me, this was all old news. I thought everybody knew never to trust a politician, an attorney, a scientist, or especially a White Coat. You can't, these people are trained to lie. That's what they do. And you can buy a scientist today just as easily as you can a politician.
Yeah.
And every practicing doctor and nurse in Canada and the U.S. today should be looking in the mirror. And when they appear in public, they should literally be hanging their heads in shame for what they participated in. But the truth is that most people who are in fact members of organized crime and or they are communitarians, they're never going to admit that they're part of the problem. Does that make sense?
Oh, for sure. So you would, what do you think of virology and vaccines in general?
I don't trust these people worth a damn. Mm-hmm. And I especially mistrust so-called whistleblowers who've been making $500,000 for years and then suddenly decided they're going to be whistleblowers. They don't get a pass in my book. They were involved in organized crime for a long time. They were drug dealers, after all. You realize that the Sassoon family and the British, these people had control of China by the time that the war between the states and America broke out as the result of a series of opium wars.
Right, right.
So, I mean, this is what they've done to Canadians and Americans. They actually believe that healing can be found in a pill, or, you know, that all disease and all maladies, all afflictions, all discomforts can be treated by cutting it or poisoning it. And so I've just mistrusted all these people for the longest time. And so when the COVID nonsense broke out, I could only just shake my head in wonder. You know, I tried to be warning, you know, to people. But, you know, my own family members didn't listen to me. In my own life experience, my mother went to see her doctor. You know, both of my parents died of cancer, but the fact is they were both asphyxiated to death. Cancer didn't kill them. They
cure.
Took that morphine drip. That morphine drip is really like, it's no different than if somebody put a pillow against your 80-year-old granny as she's drugged up and snuffed her life out. That's what the morphine drip is.
Just a permanent pain reliever.
1968, they changed the definition of death. And so the attorneys got together with the people in the medical schools, and they invented brain death. And that's so that they could harvest organs and create a new industry. And that's what we have, is a worldwide industry, quite a lucrative one, where someone can be declared brain dead in a hospital and their organs can be harvested while they are
alive, really. Oh, you're still here?
And their heart is beating.
Oh, sorry.
Made from each victim.
All right, you blanked out there. You blanked out there. So, yeah, they can be declared. Oh, here we are. You're back. Yeah, so they're brain dead, so their organs can be harvested, yes.
Yeah, what happens is these companies have contracts with these large hospital groups for the organs harvesting and trafficking. And they're literally auctioning these organs off around the world, matching them up via the internet. And so, that's why I say, this system is one of child, sex, drug, organ, and human trafficking. Mm-hmm. And so, it's all been made legal, and yet people don't want to talk about it, I guess. It's all really one problem. It's represented by a school of thought in which there are always variances of opinion, and that's an ism word known as communitarianism. But it's undergirded by a law, which its model was 70 years in the making, and it's called communitarian law. And this is what is wreaking havoc in all of our lives right now.
Do you think it's going to take, do you think the U.S. will be taken over by this communitarian globalist New World Order in the next?
It already has.
Okay.
Same in Canada.
So you think the integration of regions and megacities is all going to go through? Do you see any resistance at all? Is the Bill of Rights going to slow down the takeover of America, or will there be no resistance?
Well, people that are hell bent on destroying you and enslaving you, they don't really give a damn about what you think, do they?
Will there be resistance, though?
I'd like to think so. I haven't seen enough of it.
No.
And especially amongst the people that can actually do something about it. You know, people that are in the system and doing well in the system. You know, that earn $200,000 to $500,000 a year, for instance. I used to make that kind of money, but I don't make that kind of money anymore. I don't want to be back in the system.
Well, they're all going to be wiped out, too. One of the things that Nikki said, and I clipped it. Let me play that just for fun. She just said something.
Oh, they're gonna be made victims too. But
they're gonna take all the money. Yeah,
they think that their status and their positions now will save them somehow.
Let me just see. She gave some really good interviews, and if you want to look at the interviews, fakeotube.com. I usually try and put her name in all the descriptions, so if you just search for her name, you're going to find it. And let's see, which one is it? Maybe just play this one. Let's see if this is it.
Now with the Aruba, I was contacted by some sustainable people in Aruba.
No, that's not it. She's talking about Aruba. The communitarians took over Aruba as well. They're everywhere.
Oh, it's worldwide. If you're a part of the financial system.
Oh, here it is.
And you're a member of the UN, it's affected you. You know what I'm saying?
Here's another good, here's where she's talking. Here we go.
Mm-hmm. Well, now it's, you know, apparent within, you know, because I'm 52, you know, my ex-husband and my sister and a lot of my friends, you know, they're all middle-class people now. You know, they have automatic garage door openers, and they have new trucks, and they got snow machines, and they got all the toys, and, you know, they got it. They got their investments, you know. They don't know what they're in, but they got them. And, you know, it was all about the money and being, you know, comfortable and successful in your middle age. And the thing that is hardest for me is to see in the plans that they don't get to keep any of that.
Well, that's why what you call an orchestrated collapsed economic system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that didn't happen by accident. I mean, this is what's so interesting. I mean, if you start looking in their own documents, they will tell you exactly what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a matter of finding the right document and finding the right person who's talking about how they do this sort of thing, or looking at historical information on what happened elsewhere, because the same people that were behind the German orchestration are also very much involved with what's going on here.
Yeah, that's why I thought maybe Germany was also a communitarian experiment that didn't last too long.
Well, remember, since the creation of the Fabian Society, we're looking at a very gradual, incremental, you know, two step forward, one step back kind of process.
Everything that's what's happening now.
Nothing is done out in the open. People like Bertrand Russell and Arnold Toynbee, they said as much. We've got to operate from behind the scenes. David Rockefeller, same thing. They admit it. They couldn't do it out in the open. They had to do it through back channels, you know, behind closed doors in corporate boardrooms. This is how all this has been accomplished. And by the way, that woman that was interviewing Nikki was Melody Hallett.
Yes, yes.
Who I was just chatting with yesterday.
Oh, yeah? Do you have the interview?
No, we were just texting each other back and forth. If you go to her website, she's interviewed me three or four times in years past.
Okay.
And she asked me to help her co-host.
What is her bent? What is her angle on things? I don't know her.
Well, the great thing about Melody is just a very nice lady, okay? Mm-hmm. She's a nice lady. She's got grown kids. And I'm 68. I'm guessing she's about my age, okay? But she lives in a town in Colorado, Salida. I don't think there's over 5,000 people. And she was elected to their city council. So she ran for city council.
Okay.
And she's a very good person. And if you go to her website, I think it's called Give Me Some Truth. Give Me Some Truth.
Okay.
It used to be .info and then it was .com, but that's a good place to go. And there's you can find all those interviews. She was actually using the public broadcasting airwaves. And so she had access to an AM radio tower that was being broadcast over five states in Colorado. And I thought, wow, fantastic. And so she asked me to help her or just to join her in doing some of the interviews that she did, and I was happy to help her. But what I learned from her is what she told me once, that very often if you get elected to an office, a mm-hmm. public office so-called, like a mayor or a city council or a commissioner's court or what have you, you have to sign a non-compete non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, yeah, I heard you say that. That's really interesting.
That means that you can legally lie to your constituents because you're bound by contract. And see, this is true of people in the defense industry and the tech industry. So
that will protect you from lying because you're doing it because you have to honor the contract that you sign with the corporation that you're a part of. I can't find her website. I typed in "Give me some truth, Melody Hallett." And it's not coming up. Do you got any?
I'll help find it and send a link to you by email. That way you can.
How do you spell her last name? H-A.
Melody is double E, by the way.
Uh-huh. Okay.
On Melody. And then Hallett is double L, double T.
Oh, now I found it. It's the Melody that threw off the thing.
There. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Give me some truth.info. Is there anything?
Well, the discussion I had last night, Tim, was about this word complacent. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear it and you're not sure, well, which spelling or which word is it? Most people only know about complacent spelled, like the word that means intellectual lethargy or laziness. But there's another complacent spelled C-O-M-P-L-A-S-A-N-T, complacent. And that is a person who's complacent is the go along to get along type. They're gregarious. They're agreeable. They're sociable. They don't like to make waves. But another word that is in my entry at my website called Nine Words, is this word autarky. Now, most people, when they hear this word autarky or autarkism, they're not really quite sure even what it means. But they're not difficult words. One is spelled with a C-H-Y, and the other is spelled K-Y. You hear them the same way, and so they're homonyms, but they have entirely different meanings, definitions. And so that's the trouble with language. Language as a tool, it's like any technology, like any tool, can be wielded for good or for ill, as we understand.
Yeah, her website's a little out of date. I see an interview from you from 2012. So
old.
I don't see last night's interview, but okay.
Oh, well, that was you want to go to republicbroadcastingarchives.org.
Oh, okay.
Republicbroadcastingarchives, plural, .org.
Okay. All right.
And then scroll down for Incendiary Radio. Incendiary Radio. Yeah. See it?
With Robert Ravel yesterday?
Yep. Hours 1 and 2. If you look at hour 1, you'll see that I'm filling in.
Oh, okay.
That was yesterday.
Lark fills in for Robert. Okay.
There you go. Yeah. All I was doing was going to, because I'm a lousy radio host.
Okay.
But I wanted to do Robert a good turn because I've known him for 10 years. He lives in St. Louis.
Okay.
248-825. Why do you need to know about this C word?
So you're
why should you care?
So you're talking about communitarianism what? There, huh?
Of course, yep.
Is that all you're
and
talking
if you,
about?
why bother talking about too much of anything else? I have to talk about it because so few
funny.
People do.
Yeah, that's funny. That's pretty cool.
If you just use the site search feature at that website and just put the words Lark in there, you'll see all kinds of stuff.
You'll show up, eh?
There you go. Yeah, I like that.
What's that?
A. That's Canadian, right?
Yeah, it's a little Canadian. I'm sorry about that.
When you say A, that's distinctly. No, it's charming.
No, I know I shouldn't say that. It's a bad habit. I don't want to be a typical Canadian. But all right.
I want you personally to become familiar with the work of Cindy Niles and Julianne Romanello.
Okay.
And you're going to discover there are other people around them, because this will illustrate for you or anybody else what is being talked about in very small circles that really needs to be expanded. And it's something that, frankly, for anyone listening,
yeah,
if you speak English, you need to know about these things. Because if you don't know who and or what is your enemy, then just as the example in Sun Tzu in The Art of War says, yeah, if you know yourself and yet do not know your enemy, then you can expect to lose half your battles. And you cannot possibly win all your battles or prevail in all your battles unless you know yourself and your enemy. Well, I submit to you this. If you do not know about communitarianism and communitarian law and how it has become so pervasive and how it is impacted upon the energies and the activities of so many people around you, then you're not going to realize who your enemy is. And most people, when they claim to know themselves, the truth is that, well, maybe not so fast. Maybe we really don't know ourselves. And then when you don't know who the enemy is at all, and you want to point to this group or that person or this group, you know, Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab and Henry Kissinger and I don't know, you know, Hitler, Stalin, and Tojo combined.
Yeah.
Guess what? There's three fingers pointing back at you.
You better wake up. You better wake up, people. And I know this is communitarian. It's kind of a boring topic. I get it. It's not media fakery. But it's real. And it's happening. And the words, all the clues are around you. It's really, like you said, nebulous. It's a difficult concept to get your head around. But you should know about it, because this is why they say you'll own nothing and be happy. Because they're going to take care of everything for you, and they're going to take care of you, including ownership of your body, which is...
Well, remember, communitarianism has been called the final solution.
Really?
And the reason it's been called the final solution is because it's so perfect that no new conflict or debate need arise in the Hegelian dialectical conflict model.
Jesus. Okay, well, thanks a lot. You gave a couple hours of a long show, but very interesting. And like I said, it's hard to get your head around, but you should listen to... some of your broadcasts, go to your website. All the links are in the show notes tonight. I'm not going to say them. You can go to the show notes for tonight's show and take a look at them and click them, and many other websites that Lark mentioned I've linked to as well. And Lark, thanks for your time, and we'll have you back in the future since you keep talking about this. So if I see something interesting, or you want to bring something interesting up on the subject, hit me up, and I'll mention you when I finally get a hold of Nordica.
By the way, if you find someone that has actually read every single word on my website,
mm-hmm,
which will take less than an hour, ask them to raise their hand and let you know. I want to actually talk to that person.
Okay. You heard it. If anyone on this that listens to this broadcast reads Lark's website, let me know and I'll let him know.
Shoot me an email.
All right, man. Thanks for the broadcast, and good talking to you. All the best.
Yeah, nice talking to you.
All right, take care. And thank you for listening to the show. Remember, fakeologist.com/donate. If you like the show, support independent media. You pay whatever you think the show is worth. It's value for value. There are no paywalls. All the archives are free. And don't forget, if you want to watch the video portion of this, fakeotube.com. That's my video platform. It does cost money to run. And if you think you can help pitch in, I'd appreciate that too. And tomorrow is we're going to talk crypto again with Uncle Vigilante. I don't know what's happening with crypto, but as everything goes down, you're going to need an alternative financial system. I don't know if crypto or any of these cryptos are the answers, but it's good to know about them just in case. So we'll talk to you all later. It's late. Have a good night. Thank you again, Lark. All the best.